Okay, should we start? We've really done much better starting on time than we used to. Very proud of ourselves, at least when I get here on time myself. Talking about Francis Schaeffer's two-story critique of worldviews, I've eliminated the subtitle here. Running short on time in doing my PowerPoints. Subtitle being, with examples from some of Boston's intellectual celebrities. Before I start to mention the next couple of things coming up on subsequent Fridays, next Friday is the Two Great Human Longings, Lost and Found by Ben Kies. That's the 9th of June. The 16th, Engine Against the Almighty, Reflecting on Prayer with Help of Poets by Sarah Chestnut. These things are out front to look further in the, I won't give you any further in the future. Not that I trust your memory or anything, but it could be time wasted. Tonight, two-story worldview of Francis Schaeffer. When we opened this branch in 1980, I was sort of determined to that this branch would not be spend its time just monitoring and repeating the teaching of Francis Schaeffer. Because I thought that would be a tremendous failure for him. He was still living at that time. And that would be doing him no credit. But that we'd instead try to develop our own ideas, standing on his shoulders as best we could manage, which is their big shoulders and fast-moving shoulders to stay, to keep one's balance on. So that, I'm not sure how we've done on that, but I hope okay. So in the interim, I've only lectured about Francis Schaeffer directly once in that whole time since 1980, about his views directly. I've been influenced by him on every single lecture I've given, I'm sure. But at our members' meeting this year, I was asked to do a talk to the other members on his idea of two stories, upper and lower story, as a critique of secular society in the 20th century, what had almost been a kind of a default position of from a non-Christian viewpoint. And this shape has been a very important theme in his early writings, especially in Escape from Reason, God Who Is There, How Should We Then Live. I thought I'd just ask, how many of here have read any of those three books? Escape from Reason, God Who Is There? Oh, quite a few. Good. Well, the others will be, I hope, okay. But it's good to know that some have a running start on this. It was basic to his understanding of really non-Christian thought. But before getting to that, and I'll treat you to my outline here, I want to start with a section on idolatry, as understood in the Bible, and then get into his worldview analysis, and then look to some contemporary applications of that that I think are really worth thinking about today. That's where I get to some Boston celebrities. Okay, the background in Old Testament and New Testament to idolatry. Idolatry is the most all-inclusive category of unbelief in the Bible. If you don't worship the true God, you will worship something that God has made. Some God substitute or substitutes from within his creation, which are called idols. Idolatry is an outsized ambition and has a difficult task set up for itself because unbelief must counterfeit the true God, the true and living God, who is both transcendent and immanent. If there's a God-shaped gap to be filled, but it's not just a simple hole to plug. It's a God who is both immanent and transcendent, a serious problem for any kind of idolatry. That's one issue that dictates the shape of idolatry is the shape of the God who is trying to be substituted for, is the real thing of which the idol is a substitute. The second angle, which is a really important one, maybe less familiar to you, is from what I would call the psychology of religion. And here I'm crunching down a huge amount of material that I hope will make sense. At creation before the fall, you see Adam and Eve living in two directions. Downward in dominion over the earth, which is a mastery, subdue the earth. It was their call for stewardship to do this in responsible love and care for the creation. That's a gift to them by God. But also, the second direction of life was to live upward in trusting the God who was their creator and their benefactor. These are two primary drives, very, very deeply embedded in human nature. A dominion downward over the earth, a very active mastery, and a trusting upward to God. After the fall, here I have to move awfully fast, the world is now a dangerous place and we are bent people. Dominion in this bent and unpredictable world becomes domination in order to give me security in this dangerous world. I feel secure only and freedom from my anxiety only as I can control, over-control, maybe manipulate my surroundings. Then I feel less anxiety. Then I can have, or at least I feel a promise of security and peace. So that's dominion, is twisted into domination too often. Trust, though, also then is twisted and bent, becomes over-dependence on things, clutching and grasping onto things, people, ideas, objects, and so on, that are not really trustworthy to fulfill the promises that we invest in them. They give us hope of security, meaning, affirmation, something from above, some sense of affirmation from above, of coherence, of purpose, of acceptance, whatever, something will come that will be down over us. I often refer to a psychiatrist's account of a two-year-old who he claims makes two demands of life, one of omnipotence and the other of absolute safety. And then before we chuckle too hard over the two-year-old, he then goes on to say that all of us spend the rest of our lives trying to untangle ourselves from these two-year-old demands that we have internally. So it's not just located in the two-year-olds, we get over it when we're three, but we're dealing with these two inordinate demands through our lives of omnipotence, over-control, and absolute safety. That's not a bad description, as I've often said, of the downstream psychological effects of original sin. We over-control things and we want absolute safety, both at the same time, of course, which are completely in conflict with each other, because the closer you get to omnipotence, the more dangerous your life is. The closer you get to absolute safety, the more impotent you are and the more curled up in quest of safety. Now, I dealt with these two things, both that idols must track on the transcendence of God and the immanence of God, and also idols are grounded in these two major motivations of trust and dominion, which means that idols actually come in pairs, representing these two poles. Pair, driven by dominion and trust, driven by targeting immanence and transcendence of God. Near and far idols, I would call them, near and far gods. Not spatially near and far necessarily, but near and far in accessibility. The near idol will be focused on our need for control in a dangerous world. It may give us a sense of hyper-control in the world that can give me the illusion, at least, of control over my future, control over my destiny, a sense of well-being because I'm in control of my destiny. An obvious example of this in our society, huge example of this, would be just money. gives us, if, the more of it we've got, the more of a sense that we have of being in control of our lives. What is it that you can't, which is, what is it you can't hear being promised if you have money? You know, anything is promised to you if you have money. You know perhaps a bit about what you can actually get with money, that it isn't quite anything that's promised, but nonetheless, it's an offer of security. And through having it, through controlling the world to get it, through controlling the world with it, and so forth. Interesting line on idols is in Jeremiah 10, verse 5. He says, their idols are like scarecrows in a cucumber field. They cannot speak, they have to be carried, for they cannot walk. Notice how the idol works here. It enables you to control your garden. It keeps the crows away from your garden so that you have a good garden and you get plenty to eat or sell what you have to eat and so on. So it serves you. It can't talk back to you. It's a scarecrow. It's not going to call you to repent. It's not going to embarrass you by what it has to, by rebuking you. Nor can it even follow you. You've got to carry it anywhere it goes. You've got to carry it. This is an ideal, user-friendly God. Then the far idol, which is the focal point for trust in something beyond us, is a grasping at transcendence for what it might promise in acceptance, unity, coherence, meaning, value, vindication of my life, hope in face of death, some higher message of coherence that again gives me security. An idol that which is small enough to give me a sense of control through domination is never ever big enough to give me a sense of coherence, acceptance, facing life with death and so forth. Think of money. Money can give you a tremendous sense of control, but what does money have to say about death and what death means to you? Money is pretty much mute when it comes to much, much bigger questions. For a far idol, it will be something that will speak down somehow from above. For example, though money will never be a sufficient one, nonetheless, the idea of success, or wealth in general, or fortune, has been known to wipe away every tear. If you have success, big enough time, in the way you set your goals, every tear may be wiped away. Deliver happiness and fulfillment to you in your life. Or perhaps a different angle, maybe you believe in Adam Smith's invisible hand, which means that your individual greed will, wonder of wonders, produce social benefit for other people. That's what the invisible hand is meant to do. So you mustn't feel bad by being greedy and pursuing wealth without discrimination, because actually the richer you get, the more it will benefit other people too. An important example of this, a far idol, is Isaiah 65:11. It's a fascinating verse I sort of stumbled over by accident. Isaiah rebukes the idolatry of his nation. He says, you who forsake the Lord, who forget my holy mountain, who set a table for fortune and fill cups of mixed wine for destiny. Now that those are the words, the language of idol worship, fitting, making cakes and cup and wine and so on to offer to an idol. But this is not an idol, a physical object you put on a shelf or have on an altar. These are abstractions to fortune or destiny. So fortune and destiny are idols here. Impersonal and mysterious forces. Isaiah identifies these abstract ideas as idols, I would say, as far idols. If I had more time, and I'll just touch on this, but looking at Paul's address to the philosophers at Athens, it gets a lot of, it's a tremendously famous address, it gets a lot of attention, but it's very, very interesting when it comes to idolatry, because what you see him doing is not attacking idolatry itself or even a specific idol. What you see him doing is attacking both pairs of idols, each one twice. I'll just run through just to summarize it. He starts by challenging their far idol. You remember it says, you have a god. I was wandering around town and I found an altar to an unknown god. So you've got a god who is unknown, but he's not unworshipped because they're the altar to him and everybody's bowing down to this unknown god. And he says, I'm here to tell you, God is not unknown. I'm actually going to tell you about who he is. So God is not just far away and misty and so on, but I can tell you what he's like in words. I'm going to tell you about him. He is knowable. He then immediately switches and speaks against the near idol. In verses 24 and 5. This is a real God who made heaven and earth and everything in them. So he doesn't live in shrines that we can construct, nor is he served by human hands as if he needed anything. He gives us our breath. So, you know, don't think he's a God that you can, like something you can make in the shop or in a pottery or something and put up or hammer out. No, he's not something you can make. He gives you your breath. And then again, he corrects the far idol, verse 27. And he's not far from each of us, because in him we live and move and have our being. So he's transcendent, but he's not distant. He's not impersonal. He's not removed from us. He is close to us. Finally, he corrects the near idols, pointing out that since we are his offspring, ought we not think that deity is like gold or silver or stone or an image formed by the art or imagination of mortals? In other words, we are his offspring. Why in the world do we worship there something that we made ourselves? If we are made by him, created by him, why in the world would we worship something that we create and call it God? See, we've got it completely backwards. So he then says, this God calls us to repent. We're more morally accountable to him. We will be judged by him, by a man whom he raised from the dead. So I just lay this out because I think through the Bible there's all sorts of angles on this dual idolatry, which enables idolatry to be a much more useful tool rather than just thinking there are objects people have on idol shelves or on altars and they fall down in front of them and it's stupid and it's mystifying and so on. It's actually a much more sophisticated thing going on, and I think everybody has these two sides to their idolatry. It gets too involved to go any further with it, but I think it makes the idea of idolatry much more biblical and useful. So when people don't accept God, they will function with pairs of idols with many, many variations and shapes and sizes, not just to do with ideas, having to do with objects, people, images, and so forth. Especially in thinking about these idols in this way, I realized that Francis Schaeffer's Upper and Lower Story was actually an expression of this very pairing in his worldview analysis. Was actually an idolatry critique. His analysis of Upper and Lower Story is actually analysis of idolatry. Schaeffer's worldview analysis here. His background in this was his exposure to a worldview critique that came out of Reformed theology and philosophy in Holland. Which saw, particularly, maybe some of us have run across thinkers like Herman Dooyeweerd, Dutch philosopher and legal scholar, talked about three ground motives being behind Western philosophy, Western culture, and the philosophy behind it. And those are the Greeks, form and matter. If you've read any Plato or familiar with Plato, matter, the material world, which is lowly and far from God. Form is the world of ideals, the world of ideas, the world of where God is and perfection. A tension there between these two worlds. Nature, grace is what you see coming following from Thomas Aquinas, medieval Catholicism, where he takes, in nature, he lets Aristotle define nature for him, and then he says, Aristotle doesn't have the whole answer. We add to that grace, the message of the Bible of salvation and so forth, and makes a synthesis of these two things. Then the modern era, what this school of thought thinks, and I think with some value and some accuracy, is the tension is nature and freedom. And I'm going to be spending most of the time on that. That's what Schaeffer took from this, and most of his work he did under the roof of that nature-freedom category. These are all tensions that not everybody believed them, not everybody was caught in these, but they control the basic ideas of philosophy at that time in Western culture. These were his upper and lower stories. I don't have time to go into this narrative, which would make a very good narrative, how this one developed into another. But let me say a word about this tension. And to get a hold of the nature, let's look at what is key is the origin of modern science. Starting in the late 16th century, many of the men involved in this were very real Christians. In fact, many of the members of the founding members of the Royal Academy of Science were Puritans, so very, very theologically sophisticated and imbued in Reformed theology and so forth. A very important man was Francis Bacon, writing in 1580, something like this, wrote a book calling for basically what we would call empirical science. Don't do what they're doing at all the universities, which is just to argue about how things had to be the way they are because of logically deducing things from Aristotle. Get out and look at the world. Get out and weigh things, measure things, add them up, figure out how they work with each other, and see what you find. And modern science arose bypassing the universities because they were preoccupied with negotiating from Aristotle and so on and high logical truths. But basically noblemen who were bright and who were curious and who had maybe were bored, had time on their hands, and spent a lot of time fiddling and tinkering and writing letters to each other and eventually having journals that they sent and circulated around between each other, just investigating how to make wine, how to breed cattle, how to make water flow in the right direction, whatever was necessary. And Bacon, as a believer, his whole motivation was, listen, we can reduce suffering in this world. We can make a better life for people by doing this, because we can meet some of their needs through it. Whether they be to do with disease, poverty, etc., by studying the world itself, sharing what we have, getting rid of superstitions that had been plaguing us in ignorance. For example, I just think one of the things that I've always been amused at is one description of if you take a rock up to the third floor and drop it out the window, why does it accelerate as it falls? Well, no one knew, but one of the theories was a rock belongs on the ground. This is teleological thinking. Its goal is to be on the ground, so that what you're observing when a rock accelerates is the rock's joy in getting closer and closer to where the rock belongs. So it finally hits the ground. It's all cool, but it's the joy of the rock in falling. It's what you attribute to the acceleration. Well, yeah, that's what they're dealing with, along with astrology and Aristotle and everything else in the middle of the 17th century, because it's just very widely different whole paradigms and sets of ideas. Empirical science was just one competitive here. A huge step forward was taken, needless to say, by Newton, who was 17th century here, discovering laws of motion, absolute genius at mathematics and physics. Laws of motion, universal gravity, figuring out the solar system and how things worked. No one could really fully accept the sun-centered solar system until he came along and did the math and explained how everything works and had to work that way. All sorts of other areas, optics and so on. But in the course of the Enlightenment, which starts more in the 18th century, inspired by Newton's discoveries, inspired by the idea that, you see, he's looking at the whole solar system and said, I can describe it to you mathematically and why it behaves as it does. People saying, maybe the whole business, everything we have, is able to be reduced to mathematical principles and known causes and effects. So the whole thing is working as a machine, a highly complex machine working according to the rules of mathematics. And along with that, began to think, well, if this is true, we really may not need God that much to understand why things happen and how they happen. The cause of things. We can understand more things in terms of a great complex machine working and throw off the burden of God, of Christian theology and the church, do our science and build a much better world than the church ever could build. And so this is a major dynamic in the Enlightenment that comes, that builds up. There was always a snag here, not articulated necessarily hugely in the beginning of the Enlightenment, but more and more as time went on, which is if the whole world can be explained as a mechanism, where do people fit in? If we're without God's close involvement in affairs on earth, without necessarily humans made in his image, where does human thinking, choosing, and behaving fit within this machine status of the rest of the world? Where does human freedom fit along with our reason and morality, which are meaningful only if we are free agents? So it's not just freedom as one sort of aspect of our nature, but that freedom, meaning we really make choices. We're not programmed. We're not determined by biology or anything else. We're not programmed. We actually make choices ourselves, having to do with right and wrong, having to do with true and false, having to do with all kinds of things that are really vital to being human beings. Unless our minds are substantially free, how can we even trust our own minds' scientific theories? In other words, how can you even trust your own understanding of Newton if your own mind isn't free to weigh and measure truth against falsehood and reasons why to accept one and reject another? So is there any such thing as human freedom? Is it an illusion? This is one of the basic tensions, as you might have imagined, in this nature freedom ground motive, and a huge tension within modern culture ever since. If human freedom is an illusion, what becomes of what we would call humanness, human values, human dignity, the idea of meaning in our lives? Well, all we would talk about as human personhood. I can't possibly go through the people who are significant here, but I will start with a big gun here who's at the very end of the Enlightenment, of Immanuel Kant, who doesn't just deal with this, but with all sorts of other issues, one of the giants of Western philosophy. He came through with his version of this upper and lower story, and he would be a classic one where Schaeffer would look at in his thinking in terms of the upper and lower story through Kant. The upper story was the noumenal world, world held everything of ultimate importance. God, if there is a God, all theological claims, moral principles, meanings in life, but nothing in this noumenal world can be known or described by human beings because we just don't have the equipment. We're epistemically limited and cannot understand anything that goes on in this noumenal world. So it's there. We can't tell really what's going on there, but all that's great and high is behind this or above this sort of ceiling. Schaeffer used to describe it as a concrete ceiling, put over the top of humanity as where we live, that we can't penetrate through it to the greater truths that are somehow up there. If we do describe, Kant is probably an agnostic, it's hard to know. So there's maybe a God or maybe no God up there. We're not sure. In the lower, the phenomenal world is just the ordinary world where we all live, run around, and do our things, and where we do our science, and go to church, work, and so on. But we can never there use and speak to each other and write to each other and do all sorts of things with language and communicate to each other through language. But the minute we use words, which work in the phenomenal world, to describe what's up there and things to do with God, we're not really talking about God because we can't know. All we're doing is describing our own experience about God, our own feelings about God, our own opinions about God. So the only thing that can happen to, we can do with language down here and with our own thoughts, say dealing with the, describing the character of God, is making statements that are religious opinions. What I think and what I feel about God, my sentiments about God's character or whatever. I can't say anything about what God is actually like. So this is where this ceiling above the phenomenal world is a concrete ceiling, that my words can't penetrate it. You can speak about God in ultimate truth, but you need to know that your thoughts and the words that express them don't correspond to anything ultimately real. He would talk about the thing in itself is up there in the noumenal world, above the concrete ceiling. Things can exist as maybe as metaphors, symbols, myths, pointing to something, but they are not nothing you can actually define and describe in language. Now, it's a terrible blow to any theology that followed Kant, as some of you can imagine. Schaeffer was grieved. One of the things he was grieved and angry with, how much Protestant theology had followed Kant and thought he'd opened a door to a new way of understanding, made more peace with the Enlightenment, and we can be sort of up to speed with the modern world and so on. But he felt it was a complete betrayal of the whole Christian faith, because in this way there's no God that can communicate. God is unknowable. The Bible is irrelevant, and there's no revelation or redemption or whatever. Just a footnote here, just to make this more concrete. Some of you may or may not have noticed that modern American universities, by the early 20th century, there was a shift. Many of them had departments of theology. Many of the major universities in our country had departments of theology. After the early 20th century, 1900, after the First World War, almost none of them had departments of theology except universities that had a training school for ministers. Then they'd call that a department of theology or whatever, school of theology. So they shifted from departments of theology to departments of religion. What's the difference? Well, the difference is actually huge, and it's totally Kantian. It's totally from Kant. To study theology is meaningful only if actual knowledge of God is possible. Why bother studying theology if no knowledge of God was possible and helpful? If we can't have knowledge of God, we can still study the human activity of being religious, though. So departments of religion discover or study the human religious behavior, human religious emotions, ideas, institutions, so that in our main universities we can study till the cows come home religious activity of human beings, and we can do it without any reference to whether God exists or not. But don't expect to find courses in our modern main universities that will help you learn of the God that is actually there, because you won't find them. Well, you can find them overtly, obliquely, and by accident, as I sort of did myself, but it's likely to be by accident. So the new theology, which is theology that basically has followed Kant in a very general way, is theology that accepts this upper and lower story. And the upper story is words about God, Jesus, salvation, truth, which are there because of their connotations, not because of their actual denotations, denotated meanings. They're there because they give you feelings and impressions and so on of transcendence, of memory of Christian things that you may have in your background. On the bottom floor, where we live, where we walk around, we spend our time, it's the Bible as a fallible book, like any other book, filled with distortions, with superstitions, with primitive thought forms, with history and theology, which we can't really rely on as being true. It's just stories and reflections that its authors, for their own reasons, whatever those might have been, wanted their readers to believe. So, again, the upper story, you can't say anything about it. You can have the words, but those words don't correspond to what is true, to anything that is true that you could actually describe or use words. A good example of this, a sort of extreme example that rang true through much of the late 20th century, one renowned German theologian called Rudolf Bultmann believed that Jesus' body was still rotting in the ground. He did not believe in the resurrection of Jesus. But he openly said that on Easter Sunday, I preach about the Easter event because I want to give hope to my people. And I'm a Lutheran minister and I want to proclaim the gospel to these people. Jesus was dead in the ground. And yet I proclaim the gospel about the Easter event. Now, it isn't just gobbledygook. It's a very sophisticated way he had it worked out of what he was trying to communicate in that way. But it's not the gospel. It's not what Peter, Paul, John, and so on spoke to the people that came to them. It's something very, very, very different, which is run through a Kantian filter system, and it goes through that filter system just fine, a filtering or a lens through which liberal theology has passed. Schaefer passionately grieved over this and felt that this theology justified ridicule and rejection, much of which it has received since then, by the emptying of a lot of the mainline churches who have been preaching this message in order to make connection with people who are living in a scientific age, supposedly, but missing entirely, and people saying, if that's what's there to be believed, why do I need to go to church at all? Schaefer also saw this pseudo-theology as simply repeating what was going on in basically an existential philosophy at the time. He spent quite a bit of time with some students of Karl Jaspers, who was a Swiss existentialist arrived in the 50s and 60s, who would come, who visited Le Brie, and he spent quite a little time studying Jaspers. And Jaspers, as a typical existentialist, he looks at the world as it is, and in this lower story world, and it's without meaning, it's grim, there's evil around, we don't understand it, but somehow he had, and his followers somehow had, what they called a final experience, which is some sort of experience of transcendence that they could never describe, they could never put it into words, they couldn't say anything about it. But it was an experience of some sort of transcendence, beyond reason, beyond language, that couldn't be communicated, which gave them hope, which gave them focal point in their life, made them realize that everything isn't just hopeless and grim and all about death. He made the same parallel with Aldous Huxley in the experiences he had with mescaline and LSD, who made great claims about what was experienced under mescaline and LSD, but immediately followed it with, you can't explain them. You can't put any words on them whatsoever. They're not rationally comprehensible or processable or whatever. It can't be described in any way. And he saw these as as just very much what the secular world was trying to do. This world looks is empty, it's dead, it's meaningless, it's mechanical, it's boring. In this world where we describe the near idols in this lower world, which we can control, have dominion over, show us a world where we're just like animals or machines. We have no dignity, no final purpose or meaning, even though we may make a lot of money. Still, it doesn't alter the fact that our lives are meaningless. In this lower story, our near idols, with near idols even, our honest people confront despair. You can think of Ecclesiastes and the affirmation of vanity in Ecclesiastes. Vanity of vanities. Yeah, look, everywhere I go, we are like animals that die. We're like, basically he's saying in Ecclesiastes, we're just like roadkill. Don't think we're any more than roadkill. And because we're just like animals, we die, we're cast aside, we rot, and that's all there is to it. I remember on my first visit to the Brie, Dr. Schaefer took my roommate and I for a walk. We got lost. It took us all day and half the night to get back, but we had a lot of talking talked the whole time, actually. And we left at 10 in the morning, and we got to a nearby town at midnight. And but along the way, I described him. I'd been there for a few days and realized what he was. I wasn't a Christian. I was mystified and partly horrified and partly challenged by what he was doing, what he was thinking, and so on. But I just remember asking him, listen, I could spend years thinking through these options as to what's true and what isn't true, and at the end of that time, I could still not know. So is it really worth trying? And he said, well, yes, you know, you could decide to become a cabbage. And I thought, well, I know exactly what he means. You could just give up and just decide to live and have just the kind of life cycle of a cabbage. You live, you come up, you die, and you rot. And that's it. That's all there is to it. And that image made actually quite an impression on me, as it was quite a source of motivation. I didn't want to be a cabbage. But it spoke for where you're stuck on the bottom story with nothing transcendent. What do you make? What sense do you make of life? Death is coming at us. Ecclesiastes seems to speak very loudly and clearly to this world. What do you do? Where do you turn? And Schaefer's contrast with, you can leap up and grab a hold of some irrational hope that's unable to be understood by anybody else or by you even yourself. And you probably can find something like that, or you can not give up and really see if there's a coherent real answer. In some upper story far idol, there seemed to be a hope of escaping despair, an idea of experience that somehow carries us, though it couldn't be understood rationally, to some kind of a sense of meaningfulness or hope, a leap of faith to escape a meaningless world, a machine world. I should give you one more here. Yeah, that's a picture of how his general picture of the general upper and lower story as it fit into many places. What can we learn from today's world? I want to give some illustrations of this, of the same two stories, but that are more contemporary, and illustrate another theme that Schaefer used, is that with the nature of freedom, nature always eats up freedom. The lower story will always consume, will muscle out the upper story. Science and how we understand nature for the most part, is aggressive in terms of invading more and more of life in its scientific categories. science wants to understand things in the most basic form, and that's perfectly legitimate. But depending on whether there are limits to this, can be really at the extreme. For example, you could take a human being and you could say, well, it's more scientific to understand a human being just as a bunch of chemicals, because that's much more basic than the ridiculous complexity of a whole human being. And you could evaluate a human being just as accumulation of chemicals, and that would be more basic and in some ways more thoroughly scientific. But you'd be missing an awful lot if you just describe a person as quantities of different chemicals. I mean, think of what you'd be missing just in terms of his or her body, let alone the whole person who's there. That would be an example of extreme reductionism, scientific reductionism, using science, but to lose an enormous amount of the diversity of what we would see as in God's creation. But psychology wants to be reduced to biology, biology reduced to chemistry, chemistry to physics. Again, there's something intrinsically legitimate in this, but it can, if it's reductionist, in a sense of crushing structures of life that are irreducible, then it does violence rather than does truth. In a review in Harper's Magazine that I'll refer to in a minute, the reviewer said, the scientific worldview is epistemically greedy. It is epistemically greedy. That means it wants more. It wants to invade more turf more thoroughly. Now, I want to read a thing by a Jewish historian that I read it before on some occasion here. It's a couple of pages by him, by this guy, Yuval Noah Harari, an Israeli historian, because he wonderfully illustrates this process of what happens when you turn loose scientific analysis on something and what happens to it. He, to start out saying, he sees humans as distinct in their ability to create what he calls collective illusions or fictions. Intersubjective realities, imagined orders, and then live by them. Invent fictions, and then live by them. Do you see what he's saying?
Do you have a slide for that?
Excuse me?
Do you have a slide for that?
Not yet.
Okay.
I'll give you more than you want in a minute. He gives the example of the value of money. Why are these little bits of colored paper worth so much? With just bits of colored paper with stuff printed on them, you can go and buy land, buy houses. What's the deal? Why is this? Why does this make sense? Well, he would say, it's only because we have a shared illusion that they are valuable. And so it works as long as that illusion lasts. Now, in high inflation, of course, that's not lasting anymore. It's an interesting illustration. He then goes and says, I consider God and all human universal values to be just such fictions. God is just such a fiction, and all basic human values are just such fictions. And he does a little exercise on the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, which I've done a lot of study on other occasions, so I was very interested in this. He describes, and he shows an upper and lower story of the Declaration of Independence, showing how the lower story, he looks at the upper story through biological eyes and comes out with the lower story. Okay? Biology eats up human dignity, uniqueness, equality, from the upper story, all universal values and ethical principles. Here, I'll give you one. Fictions about equal dignity, rights, and dignity, and on the bottom is an objective truth of biology. This is his methodology. And again, I'll just read you the second paragraph. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, I'll read you what he does with this. He's just contrasted it to the Code of Hammurabi, which was, he claims, 1776 B.C., which came out with certain principles of how society should be ordered based on the truths derived, revealed from the gods of the Babylonians, Marduk, etc., which were highly hierarchical. There were three classes of people. There were the superior people, there were commoners, and there were slaves by their most deepest identity. So this was built in to human race. And so the law of Hammurabi, he's just described it, is a whole law based on how you make civil law out of these three, out of the inequality of these people. I'm going to read a couple of pages here, so bear with me. Hammurabi and the American founding fathers alike imagined a reality governed by universal and immutable principles of justice, such as equality or hierarchy. Yet the only place where such universal principles exist is in the fertile imagination of sapiens, in the myths they invent and tell one another. These principles have no objective validity. It is easy for us to accept that the division of people into superiors and commoners is a figment of the imagination. Yet the idea that all humans are equal is also a myth. In what sense do all humans equal one another? Is there any objective reality outside the human imagination in which they are truly equal? Are all humans equal to one another biologically? Let's try to translate that most famous line of the American Declaration of Independence into biological terms. So he's translating it into biological. And here it is. I'll read it again. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And he goes on. According to the science of biology, people were not created. They have evolved. They certainly did not evolve to be equal. The idea of equality is inextricably intertwined with the idea of creation. The Americans got the idea of equality from Christianity, which argues that every person has a divinely created soul and that all souls are equal before God. However, if we do not believe in the Christian myths about God, creation, and souls, what does it mean that all people are equal? Evolution is based on difference, not on equality. Every person carries a somewhat different genetic code and is exposed from birth to different environmental influences. This leads to the development of different qualities that carry with them different chances of survival. Created equal should therefore be translated into evolved differently. Just as people never created, neither, according to the science of biology, is there a creator who, quote, endows them, unquote, with anything. Is only blind evolutionary process, devoid of any purpose, leading to the birth of individuals. Endowed by their creator should be translated simply into born. Equally, there are no such things as rights in biology. There are only organs, abilities, and characteristics. Birds fly, not because they have a right to fly, but because they have wings. And it's true that these organs, abilities, and characteristics are unalienable. It's not true that they are unalienable. Many of them undergo constant mutations and may well be completely lost over time. The ostrich is a bird that lost its ability to fly. So unalienable rights should be translated into mutable characteristics. And what are the characteristics that are involved in humans? Life, certainly, but liberty? There's no such thing in biology. Just like equality, rights, and limited liability, and equality, rights, and limited liability companies, liberty is something that people invented and that exists only in their imagination. From a biological point of view, it's meaningless to say that humans in democratic societies are free, whereas humans in dictatorships are unfree. What about happiness? So far, biological research has failed to come up with a clear definition of happiness or a way to measure it objectively. Most biological studies acknowledge only the existence of pleasure, which is more easily defined and measured. So, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness should be translated into life and the pursuit of pleasure. So here is that line from the American Declaration of Independence, translated into biological terms. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men evolve differently, that they are born with certain mutable characteristics, and that among these are life and the pursuit of pleasure. Now, that makes his upper and lower story. Jefferson has written the upper story here, which is filled with transcendent references. His translation into biological is on the lower, on the lower story. Advocates of equality and human rights may be outraged by this line of reasoning. Their response is likely to be, we know that people are not equal biologically, but if we believe that we are all equal in essence, it will enable us to create a stable and prosperous society. I have no argument with that. This is exactly what I mean by imagined order. We believe in a particular order, not because it's objectively true, but because believing in it helps us to cooperate effectively and forge a better society. And so on. Now, interesting, for all sorts of, I go on much too long about this. First of all, I'm fascinated by his honesty in connecting the equality and dignity of all people to the Bible, to the Christian idea of Creator. So many political scientists look at this and they are embarrassed by the existence of a Creator in the Declaration of Independence and the integral role that the Creator has in establishing equality and making equality true at all. And so you see all sorts of tap dancing around the presence of God in this thing, because it's only God who upholds this basic cornerstone of liberal democracy. I mean, what's liberal democracy without human rights, human dignity, and human equality? Where in the world are we politically? So you can see what reducing something to biology and biological categories does. There's a lot that's lost. And for him, he sees, well, this is now objective. This is not just filled with imaginative fictions. It's not... you see nature, biology, if it's not answerable to God's revelation or checked by God's revelation, will reduce human affairs down to something that is biologically understandable. It's sort of like to a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so in biological understanding, everything that you get a hold of has got to be biologically defined, and which has no room for rights, no room for dignity, no room for such things as made in the image of God. And again, he says this is objective. I don't think this version of the Declaration would have fired up many people to start a revolution, because it basically asserts almost nothing of consequence. But he sees with clarity that he has no solution except trying to sustain this illusion as long as we can, which is, he says, or else maybe we can come up with another illusion when this one runs out that will sustain these wonderful principles, which he loves, of human dignity, human rights, and human equality. Because he wants to cooperate effectively to forge a better society. Now, he has a deeper sense of honesty than most of the people have looking at this whole question. Because he says, what he's seen is, without God, you surgically remove God from this picture, and you are in massive trouble justifying everything that we value in liberal democracy. Do we depend on a collective fiction to have a good society? He described the whole Enlightenment impact as sacrificing meaning for power, which is very interesting, the whole advance of science, sacrificing meaning for power. Science gives us understanding that brings power and to our in our control, but losing the meanings like dignity, equality, and rights. Take time reading that, because it gives you a good example of the whole process of biological reductionism, which we don't have time for in the other areas, but I'm just going to give you shift on to some of our Boston celebrities now. Not as much time as I wanted. I wanted to deal with a couple more, but we're running short of time already. Start out with E.O. Wilson. a scientist of the whole natural world, but who's still one of the world experts, probably me, the world expert on ants. Taught biology at Harvard for many years. He had a Christian background, which he repudiated. Let me see. I'll just put you back to... Sorry. This now. We're on the Boston intellectual celebrity side here. he rejected it and has become a real evangelist for the scientific worldview. In terms of the upper-lower story of theme, things go more or less like this. I'll get back here. Give you back this again. He writes, I'll describe his lower story. With our own eyes, we can see through the dark glass, fulfilling Paul's prophecy. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. Our place and meaning, however, are not being revealed as Paul expected, not at all. Then he proceeds to open our eyes, he says, not through piety, but through biology. So he's not anticipating what Paul was describing in 1 Corinthians at all, but the opening of our eyes through learning biology about our eyes about ourselves. Our evolutionary past and what it has made of us. He's a complete materialist, and one of the main architects of what's called now evolutionary psychology. He called it first sociobiology, arguing that evolution produced not just our physical forms, morphology, but evolution produced many of the psychological and social patterns of the way we live. So this is evolution doing much more than evolving our bodily forms, but the way we act, the way we live, particularly in community together. So we are not free, but evolution, and get this careful distinction, evolution has made us believe that we are free, because that belief has been much more adaptive, has had an evolutionary advantage. The belief that we're free has had a reproductive and survival advantage. So, of course, that has become hardwired into us, the belief that we are free, not be determined. He ridicules the idea of how we would behave if we all thought we were determined or knew the truth of it being determined. And his view here is that there's no external grace shining down upon us, no demonstrable destiny or purpose assigned to us, no second life vouchsafed for us for the end of the present one. We are, it seems, completely alone. Now, for the upper story, I just have to shift to the very next sentence of his writing. And he said, we are, it seems, completely alone. And the next sentence is, and that, in my opinion, is a very good thing. It means we are completely free. It means we're completely free from God, from anybody telling us how to behave and what to do. And this is part of what means what the Enlightenment, what Harari means by sacrificing meaning for power, and the power of absolute freedom and no one telling you what to do. Never mind that he has just denied human freedom. He's got it himself somehow. He then assures us that before the end of this century, this is his upper story, human freedom and how, I'll read you what he says. We have enough intelligence, goodwill, generosity, and expertise to turn Earth into a paradise, both for ourselves and for the biosphere that gave us birth. He goes on to see, admits that there are certain dysfunctional religious groups that stand in the way of doing that, but he thinks it is still possible before the end of the 21st century to make this Earth paradise for us and for the biosphere. It's incredible hope. He also wants the preservation of biological human nature as a sacred trust. He's scared of the transpersonal stuff. He's scared of Ray Kurzweil and these people who want to transform human nature. He wants to keep it that way. But where does this sacred trust come from? Sacred? What does sacred mean when there's no God there? There's no sacredness. Everything is just blank fact and sits there. Wilson has an extraordinary grasp of the natural world. He writes books. He's well in his 80s now, and he's cranking out probably a book or two a year still. Way beyond the realm of ants and insects. But he scorns religion, especially Christianity, and he scorns philosophy as well because it hasn't done much better than religion. He writes, "I don't believe it's too harsh to say that the history of philosophy, when boiled down, consists mostly of failed models of the brain." So much for the history of philosophy. Failed models of the brain. Because both religion and philosophy have neglected biology. He maintains great hope in moral terms for which biology has no place. There's enormous tension here between nature and freedom, between biology and all the moral freight that he's investing in. And he seems joyful. He seems to not feel a conflict or a limitation there. This is something he swallows whole. And I think through being a good writer, he gets away with it. No one seems to blow the whistle on him. Next one is Steven Pinker. Also taught all over the place, but mostly at MIT and Harvard, in cognitive science, visual cognition, and psycholinguistics, whatever that means. As with Wilson, he's published in many, many areas. He follows the same sort of pattern. Again, a strict materialist and determinist. Pinker lays down his lower story very clearly. All your behaviors are the result of neurophysiological activity in the brain. There is no reason to believe that there's any magic going on. So in the determinism, we are all there in the determinism. In the human brain, everything is determined by neurophysiological activity within our brains. Because science has made so much sense of the world, we know that we're fully determined mechanisms, and we should accept that. But he's very aware, he's more aware of the tension. All that we call human personhood sticks out and doesn't yield very well to scientific analysis and reduction. A key sticking point in this, and if I were, I'm not going to be able to talk about Daniel Dennett, but if I was going to talk about him tonight, I would get into that in a much bigger way. But the sticking point for reductionist biology has always been how to understand human consciousness. How do you understand consciousness materialistically? How does a machine ever produce consciousness? Machines are unbelievably intelligent. Harari points out, one of his mantras going through his book is that machines have outstripped intelligent machines have outstripped human beings, have outstripped consciousness. We have consciousness, machines don't have zero consciousness, but they have intelligence, much more than we do, to do all sorts of intelligent activities. They've got intelligence, but not consciousness. Pinker calls consciousness sentience. He wrote, as far as scientific explanation goes, sentience might as well not exist. But what he means by that is that with the tools of science, the nets that you use to fish with science, they can't possibly catch sentience. It's a different size, different holes, different size. You can't do that, which is an interesting admission, at least, that you can't you can't do that. He wrote, the mystery remains a mystery, a topic not for science, but for late night dorm room bull sessions. And then, after reporting this, the writer of an article in Harper's, Christopher Beer, writes, "It's rather disappointing to see one of the world's foremost cognitive scientists, hand off such a fundamental question to stoned undergrads. But Pinker assures us, Pinker assures us that our incomprehension of sentience does not impede our understanding of how the mind works in the least. How in the world can you make... In other words, we can understand the mind perfectly, not limited at least, without understanding consciousness. As if consciousness was some frill? I mean, I don't understand. If we had him here, he would be able to make better sense of it than I can, I'm sure. While others say, you see, someone like Thomas Nagel, some of you may have run across him, another philosopher of the mind, who's not on the wagon at all. He's an atheist also. Most of these people are atheists. But he blows the whistle on them and says, you've done nothing to explain consciousness. You're not within miles of explaining it. He was saying, basically, if you can't explain consciousness in your mechanistic model of humanity, you better chuck that model and start again with something else. Which I say, amen. That's right. That's exactly what the proper thing. But Pinker is saying, don't worry, having no answer is no problem. Just keep going. It's hard to understand his upper story simply because he declares freedom to be true. That's why I've said freedom by decree. He just declares we are free, having described the whole world as deterministic. And we declare to be free, though it's in complete contradiction to the lower story. And this is an amazing sentence. A human being is simultaneously a machine and a sentient, rational, free agent, depending on the purpose of the discussion. Let me read that again. A human being is simultaneously a machine and a sentient, rational, free agent, depending on the purpose of the discussion. You know, in other words, what is true depends on what you need to say at any one conversation. And the difference is huge. Are you a machine or are you a free agent? I mean, it's a huge difference. And he's just saying, well, it goes either way. And this is, it's almost saying that he's not really taking it terribly seriously. I should mention that some of Nancy Piercy's books, she's wrestling with a lot of these issues as well. A Christian who's wrestling with these as well as some of Schaefer's ideas that are quite helpful. Last one I'll mention here on a different angle, really, is Stephen Jay Gould. Died in 2002. Again, another Harvard professor for many years, a paleontologist responsible for a version of the theory of evolution that conflicted mightily with that of E.O. Wilson. So the major battles in the Harvard biology department went on for a number of years. He also wrote very widely. I'll not talk about his science, but rather his attempt to make peace between science and religion. His term was that the two fields, and you may have run into this because I'm mentioning it because it's been widely used. The two fields represented are non-overlapping magisteria. Non-overlapping magisteria. Religion is one, magisteria, science is another magisteria. They don't overlap. The idea is that religion and science are disciplines of different fields of inquiry with different methodologies, different social functions, different authority structures to maintain their legitimacy. They should respect and appreciate each other. And so they come with two stories again. The lower story is science in general, which tries to document the factual character of the natural world, and develop theories which explain it. This is how he describes it himself. The upper story is religion in general, which operates in a very different realm of human purposes, meanings, and values, which science might sometimes illuminate, but never resolve. Again, I mentioned this non-overlapping magisteria. It's called NOMA, N-O-M-A, or abbreviated that way, because it's widely referenced as a good solution to the conflict between religion and science. I came across an interview with John Lennox. Some of us are familiar with him as a debater and Christian apologist, who was asked about it. What do you think of NOMA? And he said that immediately it made him think of Francis Schaeffer's upper and lower stories. And Emily Schaefer spoke in his dorm room at Cambridge when he was an undergraduate. And he was very impressed with what he had to say. He said that NOMA looks fine until you realize that Gould's basic framework implies that science deals with reality, religion deals with hopes. That's a bad opposition. It's a bad thing to buy into, especially when it's hope against reality. That means hopes that are unreal hopes. And science is reality. Hopes that are ungrounded in anything solid, because it's science that can give you something that's solid. So what science says about... it doesn't take into account that the borderline between science and religion is often very fuzzy and difficult to determine, especially with something like the Christian faith, which is rooted very solidly in history, not just in ideas or religious experiences, but in things that took place in real time. But also, if you think of the different assertions that I've just said tonight about science, claims of science, I would want to say, as a Christian, a lot of those are completely wrong. I disagree with them on religious grounds. So my faith, my Christian faith, makes me come and say some scientific theories are really bunk and some are not. And so trying to pretend you can make two different separable worlds out of this is really saying that you've got to kind of keep your faith very, very protected in a very private little world that doesn't touch anything outside. I'll do one more opposition here, upper and lower story. This guy is not from Boston. He's C.S. Lewis from Oxford and Cambridge. Oxford and then Cambridge. But this is a little bit of a diagram about him as a non-Christian. And because his opposition that he wrestled with is an interesting, thing going. On the lower story, he believed, he was very despairing, very depressed. Everything that was real in the world was grim, without meaning, without purpose, without promise. So he's very discouraged. But he had an upper world, which was all about the mythologies that he loved. And his whole sense of meaning and beauty and fascination was all in the imaginary world, which was defined because it wasn't true in the same sense that the world he was living in. It was an unreal world. It was a world he couldn't walk in. He couldn't talk in. He couldn't eat meals in that world. And so he was stuck with tremendous tension. Now, there were a number of steps that he took before finally becoming a Christian, but his actual conversion is an intriguing thing as he understood it, because he came to believe that the greatest myth of all had actually become historical and reality. So he took what is his mythology and all what he freighted in the imaginative world and said, it's not imaginative at all, it's real. It's real, and we have evidence of there's a famous conversation he had with Tolkien and one of his other friends who was actually an atheist, who actually believed that the Gospels were really historically very reliable, and it blew Lewis away. And that started to work within him to make him realize this huge mythic truth, in other words, things that carry enormous power and reality and truth, actually happened in the real world. So this was bringing something in the upper world down. What had represented something transcendent but unreal to him had just become very real. Jesus had joined the human race in Jesus of Nazareth. I want to just conclude with two thoughts here. First, I've not tried to engage the truth value of a lot of these claims with great restraint, because I want to engage them, because I've laid out a lot of things that I really disagree with radically in the way of scientific reductionism, biological reductionism. I've not really argued against them. I'm not challenged those as much as I'd like to. But I would just try to say that my appeal, and any Christians appealed to someone in this boat of reductionism, whether it's from Harari to Wilson to Pinker and many others, is when the theory makes you lose grip on everything that makes life able to be lived, why isn't it time to question the theory, even though it's against the massive flow of the river of modern thought? In other words, this is the great challenge the Christian must have into that world, is somehow, and it can't be made just with just making that as a suggestion. That's got to be a move that's plausible to some of the people in this, to be free from the incredible domination of a scientific worldview that it limits, that so restricts what is most deeply true about human beings. The second thought is that the Christian faith, rightly understood, makes this whole two-story worldview completely collapse. In other words, this split world is irredeemable. It's not. I'm not trying to say that we can save it. It shouldn't be saved. It can't be saved. The truth of God completely displaces it, because God is infinite and He's personal, so He's utterly transcendent, but a person, and He can communicate to us in our finitude, and we can communicate to Him out of our finitude to His transcendence, and He has given us messages. We can lift up our prayers to Him. He can hear them. We can interact. He's involved with us in our lives. We have meaning in our lives. The personhood of human beings, which is such a problem to people like Steven Pinker and Wilson and even more Daniel Dennett, the human personhood is no problem at all to the Christian. We are persons because God is a person, and we're made in the image of God. This is what we're meant to be like. This is not some violation of fighting to make room for some little place where we have some sort of freedom within ourselves. God has revealed Himself to us in language that which He created, in part to be able to communicate with us. Because God is personal and infinite, He shatters the noumenal phenomenal division of Kant and those who follow him. There is no concrete ceiling over our humanity preventing us from getting through into something transcendent. That does not exist. The incarnation has destroyed it completely, because God has come into our finite world. The Bible, the revelation of God, has destroyed it, come down to us. We in our prayers reach up through it, as we reach to God. Every time we cross it, every time we pray, or every time we read the Bible. So the two stories is the shape of our life and thinking as we turn from God and try to substitute for Him with idols. And if we do that, we get into the kinds of trouble that we've been tracking.